the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there. How are you all? How is everyone? Are you all having a great week? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. This week, I've got another cracking interview. I've got Jimmy Song on the podcast, someone I've been trying to get on for ages, so I'm really chuffed about that. And also, I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who wrote to me about last week's episode, everyone who shared it, all the feedback. The interview with Save Dina Moose and Caitlin Long seems to have gone down pretty well, and it's on track to be my most downloaded episode ever, so that is pretty cool. I've also got some interesting stats to share with you. I've been having a look at the stats for the podcast since I launched it, so I'm going to tell you about those in a moment. But first, I got a message from my sponsors, and please do listen to these. Please don't jump them. These are the people that help make the podcast happen. So first up is my regular advertiser, BlockFi, who can help you use your cryptocurrencies without having to sell them. If you're looking to buy a house, maybe you're looking to fund a business, or even if you're looking to pay off your taxes, you might be faced with the choice of selling some of your crypto. But with BlockFi, you can keep them, and you can still pay for those outgoings with a crypto-backed loan. You can use a Bitcoin or Ether and get USD funded directly to your bank account. And with loan sizes ranging from $2,000 to $10 million, BlockFi is perfect supporting financial goals of nearly any size. They have also created a special offer to the listeners of my podcast, which is pretty cool. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you'll get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral for loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral for loans over $10,000, and applying only takes less than 2 minutes. Next up, BTC Inc. is excited to announce its upcoming conference, Distributed Health, which is being held on November the 5th and the 6th in Nashville, Tennessee. This is the first conference to bridge the gap between blockchain technology and the healthcare industry. Now in its third year, this two-day conference is an opportunity for all members of the ecosystem, including payers, providers, lawmakers, retailers, investors, and innovators, to reshape the future of healthcare. For more information, visit health.distributed.com and use the promo code WBD20 to secure a 20% discount. Okay, so on to this week's guest, on to Jimmy Song, another pretty cool one. It's been quite a good run of guests recently, so thank you to everyone who's come on. Jimmy is someone I've been trying to get on the show for a while. We've been talking about it. Couldn't make it happen, couldn't get our diaries to match, but finally we did it. And actually, it's pretty cool timing. If you're a regular listener of the show, you know I've been trying to soak up everything I can with Bitcoin, and now it's the turn of tech, an area I'm definitely out of my depth on. But after watching the Honey Badger conference on YouTube and seeing the discussion around Bitcoin tech and the bug which was recently found in Bitcoin, I wanted to talk to Jimmy about it. I wanted to find out how much of a threat it was. I wanted to talk about Allmany's approach to releasing the information on the bug, some things in there I didn't agree with, and I also wanted to talk about the game theory behind exploiting it. This one was definitely a challenge. I spent about 2 days reading everything I could about the tech, about bugs, about game theory, especially Jimmy's Medium posts about it, which I will share out in the show notes. But we also expand beyond the bug, CVE-2018-1744. We talk about the game theory of other types of attacks. We talk about mining centralization and why proof of work needs to be expensive. And following this, I've bought Andreas's book, Mastering Bitcoin. I'm going to read it. I'm going to see where it takes me. I don't think I'll become a core developer, but I'm willing to try anything. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the interview with Jimmy. If you've got any questions, you know you can always reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And yeah, I'd love to hear your feedback. Okay, so I always ask you to support the show, but I thought it might be interesting to tell you a few stats. Next month is going to be the first anniversary of the podcast. It was last November when I met up with Luke Martin to record my first show, and a lot has happened since. But there's some interesting stats I was looking at this week, so I thought I would share them. So, my first podcast with Luke had 360 listens over its first weekend. And then this week's show with Safe Dean and Caitlin had over 6,000 listens, and it just short of 10,000 for a week. The first month I had the podcast was November 17, and there was a total of around 2,000 listens of all episodes. And then this month, September, I'm just short of 60,000, and that's a nearly 50% jump from last month as well. I've also had my biggest day ever. I've had over 4,000 listens in one day. I've had my biggest week with over 15,000 listens, and I've had my first week where every single day there's been more than 1,000 listens. And in total, across all shows, since I launched the podcast, I am just about to approach 300,000 listens. I think this is all pretty cool. I know I should probably keep this stuff confidential, but I thought it would be interesting for any of you to listen to it, especially if you've been supporting the show from the start, you've been sharing it out. I think it's kind of cool. So yes, thank you to anyone who listens, who shares it, who sends feedback, who comes on the show, helps get people on the show. Thank you to everyone. This has become in a full-time job for me in some ways, and I've got to increase the listens if I want to get the right advertisers on board to keep it going. So I thought it'd be good to share that. If you do want to support the show, there's a few things you can do. If you've listened to the show recently, you know I've got a Patreon account now. I've got 15 patrons, which is really cool. I'm really grateful for everyone who does that. And this was the first week where one of my What Bitcoin Did maximalists helped prepare the structure for an interview. His name's Seb. Thank you, Seb. Thanks for dipping in and helping me out with that. But also thanks to Logan, Steve and Tony, the other WBD maximalists who signed up on Patreon. So if you want to become a patron, please head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. There's a bunch of options, and shout me if you have any questions. You can also leave me a review on iTunes. Thank you to everyone who has done so far. If you think it deserves 5-star, that would be pretty cool. It helps with the search listings. You can also click on the subscribe button in iTunes. Apparently that's good for your listings. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Steemit, I'm on Medium, I'm on Instagram. I am What Bitcoin Did at everything. So feel free to follow me and get in touch if you want to talk about anything. I usually reply to anyone. You can also check out my website. A lot of redesign work is going on there. I'm gradually making changes to the content, trying to make it more useful. That's www.whatbitcoindid.com. Also on the website, you can sign up to my email database. I send 2 emails a week at the moment. I send one for the show, but I also do a new weekly curation of all the other podcasts I've been listening to, so you might find that useful. And also you can share this show out with your friends and family. Okay, as ever, I've spoken way too much. I always do that. I do apologize. I'm sure some of you just jumped past it, but for those who are listening, thank you so much. Let's move on to the interview with Jimmy. I do hope you enjoy it. And as I said, if you've got any questions, do feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And yeah, I look forward to hearing from you. Right, it's evening here in London, Jimmy. So good evening. How are you? Are you in Austin?
I am in Austin. It's great.
What's the time there?
It is 3 p.m.
Okay, wow. So it's about 9:00 here. So, okay, well, look, thanks for coming on the podcast. I'm not the most technical person. And so I've read a number of your articles and a lot of them go over my head. I found the most interesting one you wrote recently about the CVE-2018-1744 bug. Quite interesting. And also you recorded a podcast explaining about it. So let's go into that. A lot of people got worried. You wrote about the bug itself and about the game theory. I also read Ormini's post, who said it's the most catastrophic bug in recent years and certainly one of the most catastrophic bugs in Bitcoin ever. Was he exaggerating?
I think so. I mean, the guy's a BU developer, and he wanted to make the bug seem worse so that his project looks better. Fact of the matter is, Bitcoin Unlimited has had many such bugs, you know, like, well, maybe not consensus breaking, but at least like the denial of service level. There were a ton of assert zeros all over the place. The code just wasn't that great. But the fact that he found it is, you know, I'm grateful for that. But blowing it out of proportion, I think, is kind of what he's been doing. I mean, that said, you know, people can disagree. A lot of developers are like, this was a really, really bad bug. It could have been exploited this way and that way. I don't think they've really looked into the game theory of it, just because the way that you have to set up the exploit is actually quite costly, and there's a very good chance of failure, in which case, not a very good bet for somebody that's trying to exploit it. Most exploits, most things that people do in the wild tend to have a definite payoff. You know, people that are trying to exploit things, people that are trying to take your money or whatever, generally, they're already taking a huge degree of risk. They want to reduce all kinds of other risks that they can so that the payoff is better. If you're just looking for a big score, then you might as well play the lottery if you're willing to take a significant amount of risk. So, you know, I don't think that was really taken into account in Almany's analysis. And really, there wasn't any analysis. It was just sort of like declarative, hey, this is the worst thing ever, you know, without any justification. It's just, okay, like, didn't explain why. We know that inflation was possible, but it was in a very particular set of cases, and it would have been caught. So it's kind of like saying, okay, well, you know, this would have been the worst, absolute worst disaster if 800 other things went the exact same way at the same time. So it's to me kind of a nonsense argument.
So I think it'd be good to unpack it and go through the details, just because there's going to be people like me who own some Bitcoin, going to be a little bit nervous, who want to understand what's going on. But before that, I did want to pick up on one thing that Ormini said, which I did take issue with. So he said Core recklessly endangered the security of Bitcoin Cash, as well as endangering a myriad of altcoins. I can't understand why Core have any responsibility for any fork.
Yeah, they don't. And this is one. I didn't even catch that. I thought I read through the entire article, but so much of it was like just crowing at the fact that he found the bug that I couldn't read everything that carefully. But that sentence right there is very indicative. It's blaming Core for pretty much anything and everything. And that's been sort of their MO. And, you know, if you choose to fork a project, then you take all of the responsibility. That's what the license agreement in the open source project says. You don't get to, you know, blame anybody else. We don't share any liability. There's no endangerment here. If you fork, then that code is now yours. You don't get to go and say, well, you didn't fix this for me, I'm going to blame you and sue you. That's not how it works. It's not that way legally. It's not that way socially. It's certainly not that way economically. So, you know, this is, again, a Bitcoin Unlimited developer that's just trying to take best political advantage of a situation. I mean, that's a, you know, yeah, he did find the bug, but, you know, his politics and his beliefs are totally not in line with reality.
Did you see a distinct difference between his approach to publishing the bug he found with Corey Field's approach to publishing the bug he found in Bitcoin Cash?
Yeah, absolutely. Corey was extremely careful. you know, he started thinking, okay, well, and he thought through all of the game theory. If this exploit was, if he identified himself and gave them, you know, the heads up on what was happening, but it got exploited anyway, then he would get then accused of splitting the Bitcoin Cash network. We know that there's a lot of people with a lot of money on the Bitcoin Cash network. And he was sort of fearing for his life. It's like, what would happen? So he submitted it anonymously, which was a smart move, you know, in case that low probability scenario happens. He proceeded to lay out exactly what was wrong. He didn't really crow about it. He just said, here's what I wrote them. And he only revealed it months later after, you know, that possibility of his physical safety was, you know, null and void, or his he was insured of his physical safety because the network didn't split. So that was his way of saying, okay, well, you know, now that all of this stuff has blown over, let me just tell you that I reported the bug and here's what I found and I did it responsibly and all that stuff. Amini's post was, I reported the bug. Here are all the reasons why Core is really bad and they're evil, and like just brought in all sorts of nonsensical, non-relevant things into his post as if they were, you know, he would get the glow of bug finding into the rest of the article somehow, and that, you know, people would try, or like he's taking advantage of the credibility, right? It's kind of like, you know, somebody doing something good, but also like shilling for something else at the same time. It's very distasteful in my mind. He obviously has the, I don't know if it's even a he, nobody really knows who this guy is, but whoever Amini is, I thought it was very distasteful how much like that post wasn't about the bug. It was more about ranting against Core.
Okay, so let's unpack the bug. So it's kind of a whole new area for me looking into the detail of things like this. My background's advertising, Jimmy, so so this is all new to me. But so as I see it, it was a denial of service vector, which would allow the possibility of inflation. And what was quite interesting here is I've never fully understood UTXOs, right? I'm not a technical person, and I never fully understood how the problem of double spending was solved. Now I think I get it, right? Now I think I understand it, because each spend has to have an unspent output. Can you explain that all? Explain that to me like I'm an eight-year-old, how this double spending thing works, how the UTXOs work, and therefore what this bug was.
Yeah. So let's start with what a UTXO is. UTXO stands for unspent transaction output, and that's just sort of like a fancy word for saying like current you know, coins on the network, basically. So when I send to you like 0.03 Bitcoin or something like that, that's the coin that you get. It's literally an atomic unit. You get 0.03. It's kind of like if somebody handed you cash and they gave you a $20 bill, it would be the equivalent of that $20 bill. Now, you could get change for it and stuff, but that's another transaction, right? Like if you're getting change for a 20, then you hand somebody a 20 and they give you a 10, a 5, and 5, 1, something like that. With Bitcoin, you're not limited to like nice round number bills. It can be any number. And that's part of the advantage of it being digital. You don't need nice round numbers. So you can have a 0.03 bill or a 17.3 Bitcoin bill or a 0.0005 Bitcoin bill or something like that. That's essentially what a UTXO is. It's this thing that you are spending. And it's what you have possession of when you have Bitcoin is certain UTXOs in the UTXO set. These are all the bills in existence. If you add them all up, it comes out to something like 17.5 million Bitcoins, right? Like if you add up all of the ones in existence. The thing about UTXOs that's interesting in Bitcoin is that every time you have a transaction, some UTXOs are consumed, so they go away. So they're now spent. They're no longer in this set of possible things that can be spent on the ledger, and you create new UTXOs. That's why they're called transaction outputs, because they're part of the transaction. So you consume some UTXOs and you produce new UTXOs. This is kind of like essentially like making change, right? Like you put in a $20 bill and you get a $10 bill, a $5 bill, one or five ones, or you could go the other way. You put in five $20 bills and you get one $100 bill back. But of course, these numbers can be arbitrary because this is Bitcoin. So that's what a UTXO set is. And anytime you spend, you have to look. You have to use UTXOs, not spent ones. And that's how we solve the double spend problem. Whenever a node looks at the transaction, it looks to see if the inputs are in the UTXO set. These are bills that are available to be spent. Right. If it's in that set, then they go, OK, well, this is a valid transaction. If it's not, then they go, OK, well, this is a double spend attempt. It was spent at this point in the past and they're trying to spend it again, or they're spending something that doesn't exist, something like that. That's how you identify it. This bug was about a particular form of double spending. Now, most double spending attempts are multiple transactions. So it'd be the equivalent of me paying you a $20 bill for something and using that same $20 bill to somebody else. Now, when it's like a physical $20 bill, it's very obvious because, you know, like you can't spend something physical. I have to hand it over to you, so I can't do it a second time. In the digital realm, it's a little more subtle. The act of me handing it over to you is the transaction. So whether or not that gets into the blockchain is that act of actual transferring of money. So that's usually how double spends are done. This particular one was interesting. It's a very pathological kind of transaction. It's using the same $20 bill multiple times in the same transaction. So pretend I have one UTXO that's $20, and I'm kind of like using sleight of hand to hand you the 20 two times, right? And you believe that you've received $40, but I really only gave you 20. That's bad. That's not a valid transaction, right? Like I didn't actually hand you $40, and I only gave you $20. That's essentially what this type of transaction has to be. The bug wasn't that, you know, you could construct this transaction and then everything would blow up. You not only had to construct this transaction, but you also had to be a miner that was willing to include it in a block. And a block, of course, is secured by something called proof of work. And proof of work is kind of like gold mining. It takes a lot of energy and effort to go and find. And you could find it for almost anything. It's just very, very expensive to go and find. Typically, it takes about 12 and a half Bitcoins to go find one. So somebody that wants to exploit this actually has to spend 12 and a half Bitcoins worth of electricity in order to create this block with this weird transaction in it. And that's the way that you get sort of an inflation. That's what it was. Most of the time, like from pre 0.15, it would just crash the node, or at least 0.14, it would just crash the node. And there are ways to crash it also in 0.15, but it turned out that this inflation thing was possible, and that was basically what the bug was. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. So, but I've got a few questions on that. Okay, so only a miner can get it into the into a block, and you say it will cost 12.5 bitcoins to do this, but is there any guarantee that they can, is it when they have to find a block to include it in? So do they permanently include this transaction as they're trying to find a block? Eventually they will find one.
Well, so if they find one, here's the thing. If they find one, there will be some nodes on the network that will reject that block, right? And that's the key. And once some nodes reject it, then you have a fork. At that point, you have some nodes that are, saying this is valid, some other ones that are saying this is invalid. It plays out a little bit like a soft fork, in the sense that the people that are enforcing more rules have the advantage. If they're ever longer than all of the other guys and end up reorganizing. So it's actually a very dicey type of attack, largely because there's just so much risk and you're most likely not going to get away with it. And, you know, like it's possible that, you know, you can, cheat in this way, but it's also like the payoff just isn't there, right? Like you could try to like duplicate 1,000 bitcoins. Say you have 1,000 bitcoin bill, right? Like, and you duplicate that and you get 2,000 out, it'll be very obvious to people very, very quickly because it's a public ledger. Everyone can see that this is a weird transaction. They know exactly who you are. Maybe you deposited to an exchange or something like that, traded it for a Litecoin or whatever, and you know, tried to get away with it. In that case, the exchange would be out of money, and it would be their fault for not enforcing the rules very well. But it's an extremely difficult thing to actually be able to pull off. And like the liquidity for 1,000 bitcoins is extremely hard for any altcoin. Like to be able to get it in cash is even harder. So like the game theory around this is like extremely difficult, right? Like soon as you do that, price of Bitcoin probably drops, possibly. Maybe you short Bitcoin, but then soon it might recover very fast. We've had this situation a lot before where, an adverse event happens in Bitcoin and Bitcoin goes up in price, which is like kind of surprising. And that's happened multiple times. So, from a technical perspective, inflation is possible. From a game theory perspective, it doesn't make any sense to exploit this bug just because it costs so much money.
How would it be recognized, though? Would it be recognized because a number of nodes would be rejecting it?
Yeah. So there would be a number of nodes that would just stall. They would reject this block, and if there might even be miners that would have rejected this block, in which case you would have had a real fork. And then, you know, people would have been like, what's going on? There, one block explorer says one thing, one block explorer says something else. It would have been very obvious. And people would have said something. It's kind of like trying to get away with like robbing a bank, but like, that the act of doing that is like recorded on a jumbotron in Times Square. Like it's, you can't really do it very easily. There's a lot of exposure, and you're going to need at least like some amount of time for things to confirm on an exchange and so on. So, you know, as soon as somebody finds something like this out, you know, they normally just stop things, right? Like they go, okay, here's an emergency. And that's usually how these things go. A lot of people are assuming, well, if you had this inflation bug and you had an exchange, that wasn't checking, and not only that the exchange wasn't checking, but the attacker would have to know that the exchange wasn't checking or the software behind it. They were able to sustain this attack for, you know, at least six blocks or something like that, so they can get the money in there, trade it and get it out. You know, these are all very dicey assumptions to make. For that reason, unless you brought over like three or four attacks at the same time, this is, by itself just isn't going to really do it.
Let me ask you a different question. It's made me think of something. Mm-hmm. I had an interview last week with Safedean and Caitlin Long, and one of the things we talked about is fractional reserve bitcoins. And what came up was that it's quite unlikely that you would be able to get away with it because it's an open ledger, right? So if Wall Street tries to operate fractional reserve bitcoins, the only people at risk are those who are engaging in the activity. You own your private keys. I own my private keys. We're at no risk. But what we discuss is that if Bitcoin was private, if Bitcoin introduced full privacy, then the risk is there because the ledger of those operating in fractional Bitcoin isn't exposed. If we had full privacy with Bitcoin, is there a heightened risk with this kind of bug in that if you were moving coins to the exchange, then nobody would know which ones they were?
Well, so I'm not so sure that fractional reserve isn't possible, because that's essentially what Mt. Gox did for a couple of years, in from 2011 to 2013. You know, they had coins stolen way back in 2011, and they just sort of kept the operation going based on a fractional reserve basis. Now, in the sense that they weren't able to sustain it, I guess they didn't get away with it, but enough people were fooled that they lost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like any bank can say, okay, well, we're going to take in some Bitcoin and we're going to do a fractional reserve, or not tell anybody that they're doing a fractional reserve. They just have to refuse audits and so on. So, I mean, you got to do your own research, right? And keep your own private keys. It depends on how much trust that these entities can engender from the public. And if they get enough trust, of course they can do a fractional reserve. I'm not sure there's really any way to stop that, because it's one person saying, please trust me, and some people saying, okay, I trust you. And if they can abuse that trust anytime there is something like that.
What I was meaning specifically, though, is my challenge to them was, if Bitcoin had full privacy, you wouldn't ever be able to track the ledger of the bank. Referring back to the bug,
You could still have zero knowledge proofs or something like that in that kind
right.
of thing. The thing that I don't like about full privacy, especially with like confidential transactions which hide the amounts, is that you wouldn't necessarily know if there was a mathematical exploit. So you have to trust that the math will be sound in the future. And I believe that the math is sound now, but who knows, right? Like the NSA might have some sort of advantage. They could have figured out like some cryptographic solution to the discrete log problem or something like that. And they could, right now in Monero, it's possible that they can, if they had some moon math that isn't possible to everybody else, but they know how to do it, they could probably inflate Monero in some way and not have anyone know. So having the amounts in the clear, I think, is the key thing for making sure that the 21 million limit is sacred. As far as like institutions and their ability to audit, there are tools. If you trust the math behind like Zcash, for example, you can come up with a zero knowledge proof that says, okay, well, this bank has enough reserves for all of the outstanding loans, something like that. That's entirely possible.
The point I was trying to make is, would privacy add an increased risk with bugs such as the one we've had this week, in that if there was, say, an inflation bug, is there a higher chance that a adversarial miner would get away with it due to the private nature of a transaction, because you wouldn't be able to track it?
Possibly. It's certainly possible. Basically, the more complicated you make anything, the easier it is to get away with bugs. The reason why Bitcoin works so well is that they've simplified a lot of stuff. Whereas, you know, something like Ethereum, even Zcash or Monero, they tend to be a lot harder or a lot easier to exploit for that reason. There's a layer of complexity, and that the attack surface is much, much higher as a result. So, I think there's some truth to that. I definitely think, there's probably more risk as you add features like, privacy or whatever. But that said, like, if you have privacy on a sidechain instead, then you know the risks going in and you know the risks coming out. So for me, that's the way to really solve that problem. It isn't necessarily to be like, hey, you can't have privacy ever. It's just you can have privacy, but in this particular domain, and all of the risk is borne by you.
Yeah, see, it's funny, we're going off on a tangent now. The more I think about privacy, and I understand the benefits. I did a really great interview with Fluffy Pony as well covering this. But at the same time, I actually starting to feel like privacy, like private transaction on the main chain are actually probably cause more problems than they solve. I think the open ledger. Also, I read an article recently on a whole bunch of things that are coming for Bitcoin. One of them things is private transactions. And I started to think, do you know what? I don't think this is a good thing. I think the open nature of the ledger is good, and privacy brings a whole heap of problems. It sounds like you feel the same.
Yeah, to some degree. Some of those private transactions, like once again, it's all something that you can do voluntarily. It isn't something that you are forced to do. So, you know, on a coin like Monero, you're more or less forced to use the private transaction. So, and they hard fork all the time. So you are forced into whatever features that they give you. With Bitcoin, it's much more soft fork based. So you get to decide if you want to utilize that feature or not. All of the previous features will still be there. And if you decide to use a private transaction, you know, there has to be some sort of wall. This is why I think, you know, sidechains are that nice wall where it's like all the private transactions stay over there. And you can come in and out, but the rules behind coming in and out are such that the 21 million limit stays sacred. I think that's the right way to do it. But, you know, I mean, these are some questions, you know, that come up. It may, like, also, like, there's all varying levels of privacy. You know, like, a lot of it is you still have an address on the chain. It's just, you know, like, hidden better, or it's you know, harder to track who's got what, and so on, and that can be very effective. So you know, it isn't necessarily about hiding the amounts. As long as the amounts stay in the clear, you can have some levels of privacy, you know, like as far as what the conditions to unlock these coins are and so on. That could potentially be very useful.
I'm just guess you would never want something that has the level of privacy, say, of Monero, because even if the 21 million coins are sacred, you would never be able to prove it.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be able to prove it given certain math assumptions. It's just that those math assumptions, you know, there's no guarantee that they're true, just because we know that computing power is getting better and there's always innovation and there's now like this giant bug bounty on that stuff, right? Like if you can exploit it, then you can exploit it. Or, you know, there might be mistakes and so on. So I mean, generally with anything security related, you want to keep things as simple as possible to, you know, reduce the attack surface. And like guard, if you have like 19 entrances into your house, that's going to be a lot harder to guard than if you have one. And that's kind of the attitude that you have to have is, okay, there's one entrance always into Bitcoin. You can go to this other place, which has, you know, 18 other entrances to it. But, you know, like that there's a major trade-off there. The main use case, I think, for Bitcoin is as a store of value. And if that's the case, then you want security. You want just that one door in and out. And that's about it. And that makes it a lot safer rather than having lots and lots of exploitable doors.
Do you think, therefore, with the main chain, it would be ideal to get to a point where there's hardly ever any updates made?
I mean, there's updates made, but they're always backwards compatible. And I think that's the right way to innovate is backwards compatible changes. That way, if the new stuff is exploitable, you still have the old stuff to fall back on. And you don't have to go to the new stuff. You can stay on the old stuff as long as you feel like it. And the security properties of one and the other are, you know, determined by the market and not by some central authority. I think that's the right way to do it. Because, you know, the old stuff might not be safe, right? Like it's possible that ECDSA gets broken, in which case we should probably move to something else. We should probably move to Schnorr or whatever. And that's a large part of figuring out the costs and benefits of something like this is you do need to move just in case something happens and be ready for all kinds of attacks. But, you know, like completely ossifying everything, probably not a good idea. but ossifying a decent portion that we know to that we know works and hasn't been exploited or whatever, that's probably a good idea.
Next up, Jimmy and I continue discussing the recent bug in Bitcoin, the game theory around mining centralization attacks, and why proof of work needs to be expensive. But first, a message from my show sponsor, BlockFi, who can help you use your cryptocurrencies without having to sell them. If you're trying to buy a house, maybe even fund a business, or even pay off your taxes, you might have been faced with the choice of selling your crypto. But with BlockFi, you can keep your crypto and still pay for those outgoings with a crypto-backed loan. You can use your Bitcoin or Ether and get USD funded directly to your bank account. And with loan sizes ranging from $2,000 to $10 million, BlockFi is perfect for supporting financial goals of any size. With the largest crypto-backed lending footprint in the US, BlockFi offers regulatory-compliant loans that can be delivered into your bank account in less than 90 minutes. They are the only cryptocurrency to USD lender to receive institutional investment, enabling them to provide the most affordable and trustworthy lending service within the ecosystem. And they have created a special offer for my listeners. So if you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you will get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for $10,000. Applying takes less than 2 minutes, so take a look at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. And BlockFi is spelled B-L-O-C-K-F-I. Okay, so look, going back to the bug, so it sounds like you think the whole thing was kind of overblown. Bugs sound is scary, but once you examined it, you realized it was, the game theory was that it was not really worth it for a miner to exploit because of the cost was too high and they'd most likely get found out. Were there any scenarios that did scare you with it? Like, I think you talked about the potential maybe for a state-level actor who wanted to potentially disrupt the network. What is the most extreme scenario that you saw potentially that could have played out?
Well, you would have needed a state-level actor with a tremendous amount of hashing power that wanted to just disrupt Bitcoin for Bitcoin's sake without seeming like a state-level actor that's trying to disrupt Bitcoin for Bitcoin's sake. Because if that were, as soon as you're found out as a state-level actor that's just trying to disrupt Bitcoin for Bitcoin's sake, then at that point, you're found out, and then everyone else on the network is against you, right? Like, that's just what's going to happen. As soon as you know you're being attacked, that you're going to do certain things, most likely every node on the network would have disconnected that block from the state-level actor, and it would have been, like, thwarted very easily. So you have to have some sort of, like, plausible scenario that you're not actually a state-level actor, that you're somebody that's just trying to exploit it for their own gain, but make it seem like that, but while being a state level actor. I don't think most governments are that coordinated or clever enough to be able to pull off something like that, just knowing how centralized entities work. So that wasn't a scenario that I necessarily thought was very highly probable or even likely, even given a very competent state level actor. I don't know if they could have pulled it off, like high level, like super smart people that are very well coordinated and don't have a lot of bureaucratic overhead. I still don't think it would have been very easy to pull off.
That doesn't sound like a government, well coordinated, no. Highly skilled.
Yeah, no, despite all of the movies with like James Bond and all that stuff, you know, government people tend to work very, very slow. They, you know, they need like umpteen approvals for everything. They don't know, you know, how to necessarily pull off operations in ways that are, you know, especially fast moving things like this where you need to react very quickly. It's one thing if you're creating like a Stuxnet virus and trying to crash, you know, Iranian, you know, nuclear centrifuges or whatever. It's a whole other thing when you have to constantly react to something. And that's right. What the Bitcoin network kind of forces you to do. It's a real time thing, and you have to be nimble and move. And you know, this kind of warfare isn't something that anyone knows much about. So I don't know. Let's just say I'm not that scared that these guys have that figured out.
So it doesn't sound like there was really any scenario in the end when you kind of went into the detail on it that actually concerned you. There's the game theory there didn't exist for it to happen. Let me just ask you one question though. Just hypothetically, say there something had happened, there was a number of transactions or fake transactions that had got through or double spends. I think you mentioned in your article, tell me if I'm wrong, but there's the potential for a rollback.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Has this happened? So, like, in my history of Bitcoin, which is a lot shorter than yours, I don't know of any rollback that has happened. Has there been any recent example of a rollback?
Oh, well, I mean, there have been in Bitcoin's history. I think there was a level DV bug versus a rebuild basically with the level DB versus Berkeley DB bug that happened. I think it was back in like 0.7 or something like that. And it was like a six block rollback. That's called the block reorganization. And that those do happen once in a while. Usually they're like a block, not like seven blocks, but that could potentially be pretty disruptive. But again, like if you're a state level actor and you really want to disrupt Bitcoin, that's the way you would do it. You don't need any exploit like this. You would just go and get a shit ton of mining power and then mine a lot of blocks in private and then release them all at once. That would cause kind of havoc all over the place. And that's a lot easier than, say, exploiting this particular bug.
One question I have about rollbacks, just trying to understand something I don't understand, is that mm-hmm. if there is a rollback, what happens to all the transactions that happened after the mm-hmm. time of the rollback? Say there was a bug, and then afterwards, Jimmy, I sent you 50 Bitcoin, and then there was a rollback.
Yeah, so the UTXO goes from being spent to being a UTXO again. So
right.
Essentially, when you roll it back, those transactions act like they never happened, basically. But you know, on the other chain, if that transaction gets included again, then it gets included again. So, I mean, this is where, you know, you have the opportunity to spend the 50 Bitcoins back to yourself, in which case, you know, one person believes they received the 50 Bitcoin or they lost 50 Bitcoin worth of goods and services versus the other person that actually has it. So, you know, it's those are the scenarios that a lot of devs worry about. But again, that's like sort of on a disruption level that's very hard to plan out exactly. I mean, unless you have somebody that's like a real sucker and says, okay, well, I'll take the 100 Bitcoin with like one confirmation. That would be really stupid. If you're transferring 100 Bitcoin worth of stuff, you're going to wait for, you know, 5, 6, 7 transactions or blocks confirmation. I mean, not to say that can't get rolled back. It's just really, really costly. Although if there's like an obvious bug at that point, you know, that's sort of like a community consensus, a social consensus that will roll it back anyway.
But it's quite an interesting scenario for what could be at one point $1 trillion network or a $10 trillion network that mm-hmm. their scenarios that can be faced. It's not like a bank database, right? It's an immutable ledger. So it's kind of an interesting scenario. So I guess that's maybe why people got a little bit upset. Is there has anything been learned from this? And is there any changes to the approach in terms of dev or code reviews that have been discussed, should be discussed, that you think need to change now?
Yeah, I mean, I think more eyes need to be on it. When this bug entered, it was like 2 years ago. So it's been a while and processes have changed and upgraded and better developers have gone on and, you know, there are more eyes looking at things and stuff like that. But I just want to go back to your previous point about people being upset about, these kinds of scenarios. This is why proof of work needs to be expensive. If it's mm-hmm. cheap, then you can roll back stuff really easily. That's the whole point. You want it to be very difficult to change history. You want it, and the only way to make it difficult to change history is to make the process of writing the current history very, very expensive. That's the only way you can force that to be expensive. And that's more or less what Bitcoin does. Regarding a lot of this stuff, people have views about, what processes we should add and so on. I think it works pretty well. This was a confluence of some weird scenarios that ended up causing this particular bug. And now that we know about it, you know, it's going to make Bitcoin Core stronger and, you know, allow more people, more eyes on anything that touches consensus code, and better labeling and so on, more testing and things like that. But this is how Bitcoin grows. This is how Bitcoin gets better. That's what you kind of have to do.
Does Bitcoin have any form of bug bounty program?
People have talked about compensating developers and bug finders and stuff like that. And certainly other coins have that. But that's a little too centralized, I think, for my taste. That also has like weird incentives where, you know, developers create bugs just so they create different bugs just so they can collect on the bounty and stuff. So,
okay.
I'd be a little bit skeptical of any sort of thing like that.
So I often get into discussion, I don't know why I even bother, but with Ripple Coin XRP fans on Twitter, and they always talk about, and most recently now that XRP is more decentralized than Bitcoin, which obviously it isn't. but a common thing that comes out is that because there are a number of mining pools with Bitcoin, it's centralized in China. So can we just kind of talk about this a little bit and the game theory around mining and mining pools? And because you've talked about this before, right? Mm-hmm. You have centralization around Bitmain, but really the game theory isn't there because they could destroy their own business. You have centralization around mining pools, but can mining pools really execute any kind of attack, or should they, and why would they? So can you just talk to me a little bit about this side of things?
Well, so first of all, you shouldn't engage any of the XRP trolls. I'm almost positive like 99% of them are sock puppets, because they all have like 30 followers, and they show up anytime Tiffany Hayden like puts like XRP army or something like that. Like that's our signal to some script out there that basically like harasses anybody that's on. Like it's insane. But, you know, like the mining centralization argument, I thoroughly debunked, I think, in an article earlier about like what are the actual ways that a miner can actually exploit the network, with plenty of hashing power. Vast majority of them doesn't make any sense. And like maybe there's a possibility that you can short Bitcoin somewhere and then get a majority of mining power, and then be able to, you know, cash out of that short. But again, that's extremely difficult, requires a tremendous amount of money, tremendous amount of mining power. And, you know, you could try doing it, but there are, again, like it's so risky for you to do because you might not succeed. If you try to short Bitcoin and then you fail, and Bitcoin shoots up in price, now you're out even more money. It's the sort of scenario that doesn't make any sense for any miner to do. And really, I think the best analogy I heard was, you can think of, imagine that you are a business and you decide, okay, we're going to hire some security guards, right? And you go, okay, well, great. And you know, the first one is good, and you're seeing some good benefits, so you hire some more, and you know that there's your business is more secure, and there's more transactions happening in your business, and then like the security guards band together and they go, you know what, this place is too far from where we live, we're gonna go and move the office somewhere else. And then they show up to work the next day at this other place and find out that the rest of the office isn't there. Well, that's kind of what miners are like, right? They're the security guards of the network, right? They're hired by the rest of us to provide security for the Bitcoin network. If they move on and do something else, we'll get new security guards. They don't hire us. We hire them. And, yeah, we have some that really know how to manufacture ASICs and get a lot of hashing power at an advantage over other people. That means that they're better security guards than others. But that does not, like, it's kind of immaterial. Like, this is always an argument that's given by people that don't really have the technical knowledge. And it's a talking point from Tiffany Hayden and David Schwartz, I'm sure. And again, like, just completely ignore them because they are completely irrelevant to this entire conversation. And, you know, getting caught in, I have been caught sadly as well in trying to defend myself against these trolls, but it's a complete waste of time. So yeah, I would suggest that not happen anymore.
But at the same time, do mining pools have any ability to exploit anything? I'm part of a mining pool.
They can sort of censor transactions because they get to create the blocks, but Matt Corallo's BetterHash protocol would decouple that as well. So each individual miner person that's mining gets to decide what the block looks like instead of the mining pool. And you know, there's some ability there, but again, as long as the actual equipment is distributed and all indications seem to be that, you know, like they're all over different places and lots of different owners. You know, it's like one of the first things that people do when they get into Bitcoin is, oh, maybe I should get a miner and see if I can print my own money. Turns out to be not as efficient as anybody thinks, but you know, that's the reality. There's a lot of mining equipment out there and not all of it is at Bitmain. In fact, very little of it, according to their IPO prospectus. So yeah, I wouldn't worry at all about what they're saying.
So it seems like there's a consistent theme here. Like, any attempt to disrupt the Bitcoin network or any adversarial attacks seem to only ever be something that would be short term and very expensive to do and likely very risky to execute.
Yeah, that tends to be the case. And the reason for that is because the network is incentivizing everyone to basically play well with each other. If you play well with each other, there's a lot of profit in it for you. If you don't, then, you know, there can be quite a lot of pain for you. And, you know, ostracization is just one of the many things. But yeah, it's a well-designed system from an incentive standpoint. And it might just be the fact that, you know, we've been around for a while and that's sort of helped solidify a lot of the incentive structures already.
Do you consider the SegWit2x as an attack on Bitcoin?
Yeah, I thought it was a governance takeover attack. It was an attempt to centralize the direction of Bitcoin. And thankfully, that didn't go through. So,
But are therefore hard forks in that way, hard forks which have miner support and potentially node support, are they a risk?
No, it's like the security guards going on guarding some other building. Like, it's kind of like, who cares? You hire new security guards, and the security guards decide to, ambush the building or something like that for whatever value. Not going to work, right? Like, they could try, but there are all sorts of mitigations against that. And as long as you are master of your own node, you will have your own Bitcoins. Now, like, granted, there are price considerations and things like that. And, you know, if it starts to tank, who knows what happens, but that's more a social psychology thing than a technical attack. There are always mitigations against particular types of attacks. And as soon as it's known, there are lots of clever things that people can do to mitigate even the worst forms of attacks.
Are there any particular areas that you think that give you slightly more concern that you think need a little bit more attention?
At this point, it's the lack of developers, but that's something that I'm trying to rectify by training them.
Yeah, you've got your program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been I've trained over 400 in the last year, so that's I hopefully helping at least a little bit in the ecosystem.
So are you training them to code Bitcoin? Are you training them is it C or C++? Again, I'm not a technical person.
It's a Python class, right. But basically it's a 2-day, very intense class. And, you just have to come in with a knowledge of Python. And by the end, you leave with a very good idea of what the protocol is and how to, make your own transaction and so on.
Okay. So Lightning Network. Have you looked at that at all? Do you see any potential attacks in that area? Have you looked at the game theory of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's still kind of an unknown security model. It's fairly new. And it's going to take some time to harden. And it hasn't hardened yet. So until it does, I don't think it's that easy to figure out. There's a lot of speculation about it, and most of that speculation is utter bunk. But, you know, that's kind of what happens when you have people that are politically opposed to it and not technically.
Do you mean like the centralization of nodes?
Yeah, I mean, this is FUD that they've been saying for a very long time. And, I mean, you look at the network topology and it's anything but centralized. It's kind of ridiculous, actually.
Okay, I've purchased one of the Casa nodes. Have you seen the Casa?
Yeah. I was thinking I should probably purchase one, but yeah, I didn't get in it on time. Maybe I can go beg Jameson. I'm not sure. We'll see.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, so just last couple of things I want to touch with you on. How do non-technical people like myself, how do we help support Bitcoin? Like, should we run a node? How do we run a node?
I think the best thing you can do is hold Bitcoin, because from an economic standpoint, that's very, very important that people that actually believe in Bitcoin actually hold it. That's what gives it scarcity. That's what gives it value. And not all of these traders or whatever. They're just playing on top of it. The other thing is to participate in the social community. And, you know, as much as you're able, understand the technical stuff. And you know, like, your sense of right and wrong as a community actually matters quite a bit. And, you know, and that's sort of an emergent property from community. And that's, you know, write articles, tell people about it, let others know if they're interested, that sort of thing. Those are much more important than, you know, going and buying coffee at Starbucks with your Bitcoin Cash or whatever it is that Roger's doing these days.
What if somebody wants to, say, set up a node? What would you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, there are ways to do that fairly easily. I've been meaning to put together some sort of video to, you know, get people to do that, maybe on several machines. But yeah, I haven't gotten around to it. There's a way to do it on Raspberry Pi. That's like kind of cool. And maybe at some point I'll you know, create an image for Raspberry Pi that you can like just plug in and hook up to the network, and bam, there it is. It's all working. You know, like as a full node, something like that, I think would be pretty fun. But I just haven't had time to do any of that. But there are tutorials out there. It's just a matter of how much time are you willing to invest? Everyone wants everything like right now and really easily. But you know, like how much you want something or how much you are supporting something is not defined by how much desire you have towards that thing. It's defined by how much you're willing to suffer. And you might have to suffer a little bit in like learning stuff that you don't know anything about and going through tutorials that are very confusing to you and like buying, you know, hardware that, you know, like you don't really understand if you're getting a good deal or not on. Like that's, everyone has problems, but you know, like, the kinds of problems that you deal with show you where your values are. And if you value Bitcoin, then there are certain things that you can do. And all of these things are possible. I'd like to make it easier for people. So the bar is lowered a little bit. The barrier to entry is lowered a little bit. But, you know, I mean, what can I say, right? Like if you go in as deep as you want, and that's all you do.
It sucks you in. All right, Jimmy, look, this has been great. Just to finish off, what do you got coming up? Are you going on any more cruises?
Yeah, I'll be at Hackers Congress in Prague. And I think I travel there starting on Wednesday. I think I arrive on Thursday and the conference starts on Friday. Okay. And it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's going to be a great conference. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm also hosting a carnivory dinner there. So it's going to be in Prague. It's going to be on Sunday and we're going to do Brazilian barbecue. It's going to be fantastic. So, you know, I encourage whoever is around to come and hang out and have the best parts of a conference without the stupid talks or booths or sponsors or panels or boring stuff.
Are you going to be in London at all soon?
It looks like next February there's going to be a conference held by one of my former students. So I'll be speaking at that. I think that's like February 7th and 8th. Okay. More details will be coming forth in the next few months. But yeah.
And how do people find out about your course?
Programmingblockchain.com. That's where it is.
I'll put that in the show notes. And then lastly, what are your three favorite altcoins? No, I'm just kidding. Jimmy, how do you want people to stay in touch with you?
Twitter is fine. Obviously there's other ways to contact me. You just have to do a little searching.
All right, cool. Look, appreciate your time, Jimmy. You take care, man.
All right, thanks.
So what did you think of that? How cool is Jimmy? I gotta say, the tech side is hugely challenging, especially for me as a non-technical person, but I do enjoy reading about it. I know I was out of my depth with this, but it was really good to just to get into the tech and try and understand what was going on with this recent bug in Bitcoin, what the game theory was behind it, because there was a whole bunch of articles out there saying how disastrous it was. But it was pretty cool to hear Jimmy explain the game theory of exploiting it. And actually, you know, quite interestingly, it has actually been exploited on another chain. I read this week that Pigeon Coin, which I'd never heard of, was exploited, and people, I think it was about $15,000 they got from exploiting the bug. But yes, it was good to hear about it. It was good to try and understand the game theory and research it. And I do appreciate Jimmy coming on the show. So listen, if you enjoyed it, please do support the show. Do consider becoming a Patreon, which you can do at patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. Do please leave me a review on iTunes or subscribe on iTunes. Both things help the show. Follow me on social media. I'm at whatbitcoindid on Twitter, on Instagram, on Steam, on Medium. Please check out my website. It's www.whatbitcoindid.com and sign up to the newsletter. And please do share this out with your friends and family. Listen, I hope you all have a great week, and I look forward to bringing you a new show next week.